This audiobook has been compiled by Bipolar Bob specifically for the Pirate Bay using technologies developed by Microsoft and Amazon. Please visit Bob's website at www.bipolarbob.me. You can also email Bob on bob@bipolarbob.me. Titanic. A Perfect Crime. A novel by Patry Patrick. Prologue. Atlantic Ocean, April 1912. The yellow-funneled steamer moved stealthily upon the dark barren waters of the Atlantic. She rode heavy in the water, dragging white foam at her stern as she slipped quietly through the night, cutting across the dark expanse of the Atlantic surface. The black of the night sea was an ideal place to obscure the presence of this flagless ship and shade her identity as she plowed through the vast waters. Its crew huddled against the chill of the frigid waste. Cigarette smoke emerged in small clouds from among the men on deck as they stood unsure and nervous, watching chunks of ice, solid and quiet, pass the bow. A depth reader hung from the empty flagpole at the ship's stern. With the lift of the waves, the moonlight glinted off a heavy steel ram, hidden below the waterline on the prow of the ship, a design differing only slightly from the rams used by the Romans. It proved a deadly weapon. It had etched to take on an iceberg straight in two, or the hull of any vessel deemed worthy of its sharp steel, backed with the force of the ship's speed. The ship's captain stood on the bridge, his cap snug over his head, trying to grasp every bit of warmth that he could muster in this weather. He readjusted it, yanking it down over his left ear and rehearsing an oft-muttered curse, as his right ear popped out into the night air. Thick gloves and a heavy wool coat made it difficult to tell how large he truly was, though his bulk reached almost to the ceiling. The tight quarters seemed just as old an enemy as his too small cap. His breath came out in puffs that drifted behind him in a microcosm of the ship's great, yellow stacks. Off with the lights. The crew, cold and grim as they were, moved into action. The ship went dark and silent but for the quiet hiss of seawater being cleft by the ram. Big chunks of ice brushed the sides of the ship. The ship's call box on the bridge crackled to life, and the voice of the radio operator came through. "Aye, Captain." The captain's hand reached easily for his binoculars without him taking his eyes off the sea, as if he had done this 1,000 times. He was deep in concentration as his eyes began scanning the horizon. He watched the sea intently. He had found what he was looking for. In anticipation, the men watched the breath leave his mouth, as he called up to the crow's nest. "Watch her, Mark." He strode a fast pace to the radio room and leaned over the shoulder of the operator, who had one ear bent to his headphones as he squinted at the readout with a tiny bullseye lamp, the largest allowed while the ship ran dark. "Get me those bearings, Mr. Hudson." "Swiftly," the captain demanded. "Aye, aye," the operator replied. "Then, I got her call, sir." He paused, looking back and then up for some sign on the captain's face. "Shall I signal?" The captain scanned back across the sea to the horizon in the cold night. "No. No signal. Stand by." The captain managed the tight quarters and then returned unerringly through the dark compartments to the bridge. "Three funnels, stand down." "It's not her." "Stay dark." "Let her pass." His breath rose against the frigid air, like a bleak steamy cloud disappearing into the great expanse before him this mid-April. The pilot nodded and turned the ship, the speck on the horizon growing no larger and then, a few minutes later, vanishing behind them. An hour passed with the captain searching the horizon and the crew tending their stations with a minimum of murmured conversation and uncertain glances. Then, something appeared on the horizon which the captain met with no surprise, but it had his full and methodical attention. As the object drew closer, what was at first a smudge of bright cloud resolved into a massive liner, well lit, its stacks puffing. She sat alone on the vast sea, her lights reflecting off the water before her, starlight reflecting off the sea on either side. The sight was interrupted by the captain's command. She seemed to be gliding along, glistening in the night, ever so beautiful into the starlit sky. Make speed. Ramming speed full ahead, came the flagless captain's cold words. Battle positions. Now the crew shot to the call. This was the word they had waited for. Their hands tensed up, they were going to see action. They were now aware of the target and they knew it meant impact. They had the element of surprise on their side and a hardy battle cruiser under their deck. Set direct course. Increase to ramming speed. Full steam ahead. The crew's uncertainty melted away as they shot to action. Above, the deck was secured for combat, and men braced themselves in the ship for impact. Below, strong, pale backs covered in sweat and coal dust shoveled at a mighty pace to stoke the fire. Heat blasted through the engines until the captain's order was fulfilled. The whoosh of heat turned the pistons fiercely, till the captain's purpose was served at 27 knots. The quietness of slicing through the ocean was accompanied by the bellow of steam and the white foam spraying off the ram. Closer and closer the battlecruiser rushed, an almost invisible predator bearing down upon the great liner. Every knuckle on the ship turned white as the crew braced for impact. The churning engines on full, displacing the water behind her, brought the target closer and closer. The speed now was full. The crew was at the ready, their life vests on, as they were now upon the target. It would be a deadly blow. The ram was aimed at the target. Stations, said the captain. The ram crashed, violently ripping a hole in the steel hull of the liner. But strangely, no crew atop the liner stirred to action. No activity was visible on the deck of the liner at this hour. A small vibration in a water glass was noticed by a passenger in the bow section stirring from bed. So big she was, this liner, that the hole in the force was only a slight jolt, but the rip was severe. The crew shuddered at their cruiser's impact. The captain yelled, "Reverse engines!" Water flooded inside the liner as the battle cruiser reversed propellers. He could feel the interior hull of her target, such was the hole. Screeching metal and wrenching sounds came as she pulled herself out of the gaping wound. The captain looked off to his lifeboats. "Send off too," he said. "Then make south, due west." And no sooner was this said than the dark flag-poled ship headed away, into the shadows from which it had come. A couple of quiet hours passed while two yellow lifeboats bobbed, empty, by the side of the wounded liner. Then a pair of men in overcoats slipped down and out of the ship's D-door closer to the waterline and wrangled in the closer of the waiting lifeboats. As they climbed in, they saw a body floating in the freezing water, wearing full evening attire and a life vest. Its eyes, frozen and lifeless, met theirs, the white skin reflecting in the moon's only light. In their rush to depart, they hurriedly grabbed the oars and rowed at a fast stride, past the propellers and away from the sinking ship. Two more bodies, well-dressed men, floated, dead and stiff, bobbing in the gentle, frigid current. The lifeboat made its way to the dark steamer, now waiting miles off, where they were taken aboard. The engines came back to life and the steamer began to move swiftly out of the area. A grand explosion erupted on the liner in the distance, lighting the dark sky around it. Turning their heads to the sound, the men saw the explosion. The ship broke into a V-shape and then she went down fast. So it was that the mysterious vessel took its leave, beneath the dark sky, and made a clean, unnoticed escape into the night, in the vast waters of the Atlantic. Chapter 1. North Atlantic Ocean, 1993. In the cold, cold, black waters of the deep, two bright green eyes glowed as they slid swiftly and silently through the water, with an air of unshakable authority. The eyes focused straight ahead, concentrating on their passage through the seaweed's long, floating fronds, totally unafraid of all the other lurking inhabitants of the dark, forbidding North Atlantic Ocean. As the creature moved further down into the freezing depths, the other inhabitants, uneasy with sudden flurries of movement, felt rising panic and fled from its imposing presence. It had ownership of its domain just as would a great white shark, in total command of its own watery territory. Those terrifying eyes pierced the depths below as if they had scented prey, but suddenly, unexpectedly, the slick gray body turned around with a long arcing motion and headed back to whence it came, as it spotted a target. Below the turbulent ocean's surface, in the gloomy late afternoon, winter twilight, it headed for the legs of a driver treading in the water above. The creature made its way towards the surface, turning its attention there now, heading for this target. Even as the diver spotted the creature, he seemed frozen to take action, as it moved in. The large green eyes shot rays of light through the translucent ocean as it drew closer. Now on the surface, the driver swam and climbed atop the frame, riding the creature-like thing. It was a battle of the waves to stay on, as he attached a cable to the wild-eyed metal monster. Then he gave way to a dinghy waiting to bring him in. The creature floated about until it was hoisted by the thick chain, churning and beat as it was reeled in. Danny Hines adjusted his gloves and grabbed a long pole. "Winch her aboard," Danny yelled. The two-eyed creature was hoisted aboard the waiting ship, the Atlantic Siren, a small to medium-sized vessel, clearly past its best days. "I got her," he said. As she rocked in the air, his swift and strong arm swung out to grab the chain and calm the swaying monster. "What a fight she was," Billy said. Billy Ward was still in his wetsuit as he helped reel the giant chain, and the creature was taken aboard. Then, silent and still, the metal creature lay helpless on the ship's brine-sodden deck. Its eyes were now dark and cold, and they no longer emitted the intimidating greenish glow. "Crack the tin," said Kyle Johns, a heavy-set technician. Johns, just a little past his prime, with receding hair and a couple of day-old stubbles on his chin, came toward it. The wheel hatch squeaked as he turned it open. "She was perfect. Depth indicators are good. Instrumentation panel is all good. There ain't 1 inch of space left in there. That is one tight-ass cockpit," Flynn said, as he came out the hatch. "Get out of my ride." "I can take it from here," said Johns in his East Coast accent. "Greg, check the telele. She was sticking. Slap some bee grease on her." "Billy, the jettison switch needs a going over," said Flynn. Johns pushed him aside as he passed. Flynn knew when Johns was agitated not to mess with him, but Flynn was not backing down. He didn't want to fight, not now, so he moved under the craft to adjust some gears without a word. He just wanted the job here. He needed the money. Johns never liked Flynn in the first place. There was rivalry. Johns was angry that Flynn had taken the submersible out. It was his, or so he thought, but Flynn was a technical whiz and that made him the choice for testing, even though Johns may have been a better driver. It was a tight community of wreck seekers, not good to burn bridges in the small world of divers, especially with men whom you might have to count on to save your life. But that all went out the door when tempers were high. Flynn and Johns were chosen, because they fit the budget. They turned as a smaller craft arrived up next to them. Jade Jones climbed aboard. Her jeans showed a nice figure. Her skin had a glow. She remained silent until on board. She held a camera strapped to her shoulder as if it were a natural thing. She was a freelance documentary filmmaker. Flynn helped her up. Her eyes were pleasant as she looked over the bunch. Mac Barden followed, as he handed Flynn their luggage. John Masters, head of the Titanic exploration, stood in the doorway. A cold breeze and a whistle of wind through the shims in the floor announced his presence. Masters had always commanded attention. He had watched Jade's arrival and moved to the rail as she boarded. Jade caught sight of him. The sun glared as it backlit Masters, so Jade couldn't see his face. "Here are the filmmakers," he gestured. "Hey, that's Flynn." "I'm Johns," said Johns.
"That's Billy and Danny."
"I'm Jade," she introduced herself, "and this is Mac." "Show them around," Masters said, and left. He was a distant man and his abrupt presence went unmentioned, as if it were a common thing. They settled in as the waves moved in routine. Their cabins were below and good enough accommodations as could be expected. Jade and Mac toured the boat with wonderment at the expedition, never aware that all life would change in the hours left. She felt the subtle movement of the ship and wasted not a moment. She held the camera to her eye and filmed Flynn as he checked the metal-eyed creature further. Flynn was a character, a real gearhead, used to being on the sea. He was born for this kind of thing and never turned down a chance to salvage wrecks. His face showed signs of sun and sea. His lean body angled under the craft to check every detail. He knew his stuff. His life depended on his expertise, so he wasn't to be distracted by this camera lens pointing at him. In a nonchalant way, he was flattered that she was giving him this attention. He shifted his eyes low. He dared not look over to her, but he felt her lens on him. It was nice how the camera distanced the long moment she took. Her hand focused the lens easily, catching his attentive touch to the craft. He moved his longish hair from his face and pulled his cap snug. Mac had a glint of adventure in his eyes as he removed the protective plastic wrapping from around his camera and loaded it as he looked over to her. He and Jade had been hired by the Titanic Historical Society to document the events surrounding the latest venture to the famous Titanic. Mac cared for the equipment and watched her back. It didn't take a lot to get him going on an interesting conversation. Jade liked that about him. He knew her to be most stimulating and adventurous. He liked that kind of thing in women. He enjoyed being her cameraman and whenever she had a gig, he jumped. And here, now, on the Atlantic, going down to film Titanic, she had gotten them the most exciting gig ever. A woman like this was easy on the eye, with shoulder-length hair and a curvy fit to her jeans. She certainly was nicely proportioned and what Mac would often refer to as a feisty femme fatale, a head-turner, but absolutely not within her hearing. Mac liked her whole package, intelligence, creativity and looks. She had it all, and he got paid to hang with her. Well, what was not to like about the job? Titanic. "This should prove to be a fascinating venture," she said. "Keeping the history alive, so that the pages are turned anew, a look into Titanic's soul." Mac nodded then looked over to Jade. She was comfortable around men. She was keenly interested in, and able to converse on any topic, especially historical subjects, with the best of them. She had heard so much about the man leading the expedition, this John Masters. He was below checking charts or some secret thing and had not chosen to mingle with the crew. Flynn harassed Johns. "Masters wants us to photograph the entire Titanic wreck site in 2 weeks," he said over his shoulder to Johns. "But batteries are the issue," he
he said, if he wants a straight run of the bots. Then he looked at Jade. Everything is complicated by tons of water. From the bridge, Captain Densler took a swift look to see all were on deck. Tuning in the radio, he got news of a storm as the waves kicked up, spraying the crew. The radio says storm warning. It might get rough, he yelled, and no sooner radioed below to Masters. Standing firm at the helm, Dendler's sun-worn hands reached forward and pushed the gears. The choppy sea was full of whitecaps as the engines churned, and the Atlantic siren tried to keep steady in place, over the depths of the North Atlantic. She was chartered by the Titanic Preservation Society and was now trying to stay stable, atop the mark where the RMS Titanic herself lay rusting irreversibly, upon the lonely ocean floor. Densler's steady hand felt the shift at the controls, commanding charge of tons of water. "Batten down the hatches," he yelled. Chapter 2. Atlantic Siren. The ocean kicked up 10-foot waves, bashing against Atlantic Siren's bow like water splashing on the stone. It was not the weather Densler would want. The waves rose up high, hit her hard and then were gone, only to give way to the next huge crest. The sea had an art of deception that could bring the ship down. Densler held the siren over each new wave the sea threw at her, tossing her like a cork in every new direction. There was no courtesy upon the sea. The water below beckoned the siren to join the fate of the majestic Titanic, swallowed by the terrific waters. This little outfitted research vessel was nothing but a tiny cog looking for sympathy in the great vastness of the sea, but the sea would not let up. Upward the waves threw her bow, only to crash down, taking the rigging across the deck. The expansion joint was being tested hard. Densler's crew rode out the storm as he maneuvered the dark and raging waters, shifting the course here and there to stay afloat. Johns heard the broken ship battle the waves as he tightened the equipment. The frightening sea was giving its warning, but the men had to secure the valuable gear. "Here," he said, handing them life vests. "Shit. I've never seen worse," Flynn yelled through the gale, "but Masters won't call it off." "Not him," he said. "The whole sea would have to eat him up and spit him out before he'd quit." The spray hit Jade's face as the greyhounding weather persisted. She wanted the safety of her cabin. Hardly weather to film in, Jade thought, as she tightened the protective wrap around the camera. She flinched at the cracks of the waves that reverberated through the hull like great snapping whips. Mac held on, unable to relax, but there wasn't anything he could do to stop the roar of the violent sea. Alone in the front cabin, Masters was a strange and silent figure, reading the charts, hanging onto them so they didn't fall off the table rocked by the storm. A life vest slung loosely on his chest, even in this torrent. This was the only sign that he was prepared, otherwise, he worked on through the critical job of marking charts and maps. The deck was no place to be. If the ship was to make it, it was up to Captain Densler. His deft steering turned Atlantic Siren into the edge of the massive wave. She was lifted high as she rode the surf like a piece of driftwood. This was a hell of a storm that darkened the sky with impending doom. Across the deck, a 15-footer smashed with the sound of a giant crack. The storm raged high and each rolling wave, driven by winds, came exploding with a crash. The Atlantic Siren tried to hold her head up. Then she disappeared behind a wave so tall it was sure the sea had taken her. Chapter 3. Atlantic Siren, 1993. The storm had passed and Densler stood at the bridge with a coffee in hand. Smoke bellowed from his nose. He had stationed Atlantic Siren at its destination in the frigid North Atlantic Ocean as he puffed his last cigarette. He had held them steady, directly above the wreck and final resting place of Titanic, 2.5 miles below them on the floor. Here is where she had lain these past 8 years, since that terrible night of April 14, 1912. "Here's your shot, only it's 2 miles down," said Mac. John scratched his stubble and looked over to Mac. "Yeah," he said. Jade was entranced and looked down in the water as if she could see down into the depths. She zoomed in on the swirling surface mass of gray, blue, black and white salty sea crashing over Titanic below, impatient to see the so sought after wreck. The repairs had been made. The sea was calm and the crew was eager to get on with the venture. On deck, Billy adjusted the highly expensive underwater camera. It had taken a beating in the storm and no doubt was in need of a critical eye. He repositioned it in its protective housing attached to the submersible. Johns came up and patted Billy on the back. "Come on," Johns said. "Right with you," said Billy. This camera was a delicate instrument, designed for exceptional underwater work. This baby would shoot repeated black and white stills that would be used to make the mosaic of images of Titanic, as she was too big to get all in one shot. The detail would be exquisite. He carefully wiped clean the lens and checked that it was still set correctly with one last tweak, then threw the lens cleaner into the pack and the towel over his shoulder, turned his back to the submersible and hustled on to join the others. Jade got him tight in the lens then zoomed out. As she filmed they moved through the stacks of equipment that they would soon be using to explore Titanic. Johns looked right into her lens. "We're gonna go over the dive. The dive procedures. You're dying to go, right?" he asked Jade. She didn't seem to have the same enthusiasm. Johns had a softness to his eyes that contrasted his fiendish glare. Busy with close-up shots of him, there was no answer from the face behind the camera, as they all disappeared indoors and into the crew's model room. Then all the attention quickly turned to the door. Masters was there. Backlit as he was, Jade could not see his face, nor discern the mood of the man who had so far kept aloof. Rob Dudley was the money, but it was Masters who would lead the expedition and for that, he expected that when he said jump, the response would be how high? All Jade could think was she wanted to see his eyes, his face, wanted to read his mood. She could feel the change in the man at his presence. She was curious why he had this effect on people, unsure why he had this effect on her. She lowered her eyes not to stare. She wanted to concentrate on the model of Titanic, but until Masters stepped into the light she just couldn't keep her eyes off him. Dudley, the money man, stood as if he held the secret purpose to the venture that was unknown to the others. He revealed, "There's a chance in the quest we are about to embark upon, that there's a fortune in gold down there. Intrigued?" Masters listened keenly, distracted only by Jade's eyes staring at him. He drew his attention from Dudley. He had heard tales before. John and Flynn leaned forward to hear more. Jade felt like she was being invited into strange waters indeed, looking to Masters to see his reaction. With the planning of the First World War, the future wealth of Britain was of great concern. As an international financier, a lucrative American banker and the wealthiest man in the United States, J.P. Morgan approached the British government with a plan to either invest heavily in American banking institutions, or that he would keep some amount of their gold safe until the war was over, at a price. Maybe they approached him? At any rate, he advised them to get their gold reserves the hell out of the country. As owner of one of the largest shipping lines, Morgan could secretly and safely move the bars across the Atlantic and deposit them in his New York banks. Few knew about the gold J.P. Morgan was taking across the Atlantic for the British government, and fewer still knew that it would travel on Titanic. The British claimed they didn't even know about it. There are no records, but my inquiries and research have led me to believe these accounts are true. So keep your eyes open, he said. He looked at the clock. I put a lot of money into this quest, Dudley said. You have all the equipment you need, he said. You better take care of it. It can't be replaced and we'll need it. We had to build half this gear. Turning to Jane, he said, it's important to get the video that Masters wants, so get good footage. That's the story. He turned to Masters. So what do we face? There's no telling for sure what she looks like or who's been down there, said Masters. It was not a deep voice, not a loud voice, it was a low voice. They listened up. There've been a lot of dives to the wreck site, Masters went on. Jade could hear concern in his voice. It drew her in. Titanic is being torn apart by gearheads. They just about pillaged her, so I want you to carry on with caution. She is a treasure in herself, not to be further damaged, he continued as he stepped forward to the diagrams laid out over a glass-lit table. This is her position on the seafloor, he said. It's been painstakingly plotted and double-checked. Masters uncovered a replica model of the wreck. They all crowded around it, jostling for a good position so that they could see for themselves how it related to their roles in the project. It was a realistic model of the wreck of Titanic, scaled down. Masters picked up two scale model mini subs. Hit the lights, he said. The room went dark except for the little lights on the model subs. It was eerie, like being down there with Titanic in the ominous sea grave. So real was the model. Jade was thrilled. After we take the first pass for safety and photos, we'll determine if we can take in the bots, he said. All eyes were on him. They were really going and Masters had made it all happen. We zero in on the innards, said Masters. This will be the first interior run. We'll be the first inside. It's not yet been searched. This was more exciting than one could imagine for this bunch. These gearheads would be first in. This was a big deal, something the men lived for. The expectation was high. These men were his chosen crew. Masters picked up the two models. We bring them in just like this, he said. He mimicked the path the mini subs would take, as he moved them low around the larger model of the Titanic wreck. These model subs are scaled to the actual size of this wreck model of Titanic, even down to the fitted little headlights, he said. So this is accurate to what we will be doing scale-wise. Masters' details painted a picture that excited them all, the process of what was required during the dive scheduled for the next weeks. Everything depended on this moment. We deploy the cameras. The exterior cameras will get the outer area, his voice was sure. We are going to focus on the two main body pieces, bow and stern. It's difficult to get decent photos in the pitch black, said Masters. He looked up and caught Jade's beaming eyes. It caught him off guard. He was distracted, but he continued. And maybe by day 5 we take in the bots. They can start filming inside her. What he was asking wasn't impossible, but nearly so. Those who had worked with Masters on the previous projects knew the best way of dealing with him was to give 100% and be ready to give more. He was unpredictable, not a man to tangle with. But he knew his stuff better than anybody. Max's camera was rolling to catch Masters as he continued. Lighting. Lighting is really crucial, said Masters. That's what's going to make the difference this trip. Masters seemed fine with Mac aiming a lens at him. It was for the documentary and would be the very thing that let people in on the difficulties of and insights into the whole process. It brought an importance to the entire venture. A film made it historical. The subs have these exterior lights on the bottom, Masters continued. Then he held up a miniature light box simulating what it would look like down there. Mac was angling his camera in low, getting great shots. This chandelier simulates a sort of moonlight effect, he said. It was a little rig of lights on poles that were set especially to light vast areas of the wreck below. Masters moved in over Titanic's model and indeed, in the dark room, the chandelier softly lit parts of the wreck. If this works, we'll really be able to see down there. We deploy the cameras and we shoot everything. We'll put the photos together in a big mosaic and see what we've got, he said. He angled the models. Step one, we do a pass down the length of her. Then you come back and get some nice photography along the top. You got the black and white cam on the bottom. Masters had them intently listening. Coordinate the lighting and camera and we'll plot a composite that we can put up on the computers later, he said. The model revealed extensive details of the wreck and the damaged areas. Masters held the two model submersibles of Nemo and Nautilus, hovering them over the model wreck towards the entrance points of the now exposed innards of Titanic. We plot the area, he added. Then we hover on the bridge and send in the bots, Sinbad and Neptune. We have two possible ways in. We have the lift at ready, as we hope to be doing a haul, said Dudley. Masters nodded. All this in 2 weeks? Billy implored. Unless you pull out your wallet, that's the schedule, said Masters. He didn't pause. He just went about the prospect of the first dive, and had planned this overview to not repeat it. Let's get on with it, he said as he rolled up his maps and put them in the tube. Jones, you're with me and Nemo, said Masters. Jones gave up a slight grin as his eyebrows lifted, thrilled to have her riding with them. Mac, you're in Nautilus with your camera. Flynn's your pilot, said Masters. Danny's got the exterior cams. He looked at Jade. Jones and Mac here will document everything. Masters turned to Flynn. See, they get whatever they need. Dive day 5 a.m., Masters finished and turned to Dudley. I'd like a private word with you. Dudley followed. This changes everything, said Masters as his words trailed off and Jade couldn't hear any more. Anything can go wrong. This is cutting it tight, Johns warned. British gold. It will be one hell of a venture. I wondered why the cargo lift? Dudley said nothing, but now I see he's been planning this and he picked his crew wisely. How the hell do we cash in that load? Can't exactly take it to the bank, said Flynn. Let's hope we have that problem. Then it'll be worth getting in that can. Getting in that can? She thought. It was starting to set in that going down meant getting in that can, the submersibles, as the divers called them. It all sounded great on paper, but as the morning was drawing closer she was tensing. She loved everything about this job, except that. It was unreal for Jade, knowing she had committed and would be going down to the deep waters below. How was she ever found? She asked, as Mac angled the camera around to her. Jones played them the computer simulation of Titanic's spectacular demise. Mac came in, his eye tight on the camera, for a close look at the replica. When she went under, it was thought that she went straight down. Jones pushed some buttons. That's why she was so hard to find. We didn't know to look for two pieces. She broke in half. She started spilling all he contents at her belly. It spread 2 miles. All the stuff that was loose, tables, bathtubs, trunks, bottles, chairs, just sort of fell out and trailed behind her. He pointed to the sonar screen and showed them. "We couldn't even find her with sonar," said Johns. "Down there, rock looks the same as Titanic. We needed good old-fashioned eyeballing. So, you'll see her firsthand. It's a real thrill your first time." Johns knew that for a fact. Jade, despite her exterior confidence, was not exactly relishing the thought of spending days cooped up in such a tiny, confined space, surrounded by millions of tons of seawater under inordinate pressure, all trying its best to infiltrate every nook and crevice of the small, fragile craft. But she needed the work. Jobs had been few and underpaid. "It's unreal down there," Johns added. "I bet," Mac answered. Johns knew that if this happened, if the craft had any tiny flaw or weakness, the 400 atmospheres of pressure at that depth would implode a submersible in an instant. At least it would be a quick death, but it did not seem to be any consolation to tell her that, at this point. "Well, it's a little testy the first time," Johns ribbed him. "You'll be cramped in there. Really tight, like 9 hours worth of tight," Flynn offered up, unhelpfully. "I'm fine," said Jade. "You're gonna be blown away for sure." "It's tight, but where else do you get a chance like this?" said Johns without expecting a reply. They grabbed their cameras and made their way down the companionway. Johns grabbed her bag as a gesture. They headed to the cabins. Jade's eye caught Masters as he walked alone on the deck. Jade paused for a moment, wanting to know more, but then headed to the cabins with Mac and Johns. Johns went in and put the bag in the cabin. Jade waited a moment at the door and spoke quietly to Mac, as she took him aside. "I'm scared shitless to get in that Nemo thing," Jade shared. She felt the fear. Jade and Mac went in. "How many times have you been down?" she asked. "A few different wrecks," Johns quipped. "Don't worry. You make out your will, check your insurance and go for it." As he was about to leave, Jade grabbed his cigarette and took a puff. She was so charming that he did not mind at all. "You don't smoke," Mac exclaimed. "And you can't chicken out. If I go, you go too. That's the deal. Masters will keep you safe. He's the best." John sincerely meant it. "This is the one and only chance we're gonna get," Mac jammed in. It took some nerve to make the trip to Titanic. With some admiration for her determination not to give in to her worst fears, Johns felt she was a real part of the team. "You like him?" Jade asked, as she wondered about Masters. "What's not to like?" "I trust him," said Johns. "He's making all this happen. He's a genius." With that, Johns left. She knew he was right. She felt secure about Masters. She checked the equipment one last time, looked through one of the lenses and packed it away in its case along with a few extra bits and pieces. She was set. "I'll take the small camera and 4 batteries. "You got enough, Mac?" Then she dared ask, "What do you think of Masters?" She picked up a book, Depths of Titanic. It was one of the books Masters had written about his adventure with the sunken wreck. It was a paperback, the cover had a picture of the rusted bow and Masters' name under the title. It had a few doggered pages and a couple of bookmarks. You could tell Jade had plowed through it taking notes. Mac thought she was taking Masters all too seriously. He said, "Shouldn't that be called Deaths on Titanic?" Chapter 4. Atlantic Siren, 1993. That night she sat on deck, and with the thoughts of the day ahead she read depths of Titanic, Master's book. With a dim light and a bottle of wine, alone and quiet, she wondered about this man Masters, hoping that by reading his book some clear, easy insight would be told to make him easy to understand, like she could find the answer to what made him tick somewhere in the pages. But as she read he became more of a mystery to her. He was as much a mystery as was Titanic. She had all his books on Titanic. The intrinsic details he brought to life made one want to brave the depths and explore her. The secrets of Titanic, her infamous captain, and the passengers were fascinating characters, all worthy of mention in her documentary. The stories, no matter how old, were riveting and many juicy secrets lay in store. Jade would make that part of the journey. Master's book would have to be read between the lines to find the mystery of him, if indeed it was there at all. Her inquisitive nature led her to delve deep into things that interested her. Masters had become one. She found herself drifting in and out of the book and thoughts of Masters raced through her mind. She was intrigued by him. In the still quiet it hit her she was going 2 miles straight down into the ocean. Just because he was crazy enough to do it, did she have to be? She wanted to talk herself out of it. But the money was too good. She questioned why she had gotten the job. She finished her glass of wine as she studied the picture she had of Margon. Just then Johns and Masters came over. John sat down and picked up the bottle. Masters leaned at the rail. "Do you really think there is gold down there?" she asked. "This is a hell of a chance. I don't think anyone has had the equipment to get there before us. Do I think there is some risk? Yeah. Tackling it will take some balls, but that being said, it could really pay off. With our gear, if it's down there and we find it, it's ours." Johns grinned slightly. "Getting it out is another matter. How would Morgan transfer all that gold? Put yourself in his position. Would he do it all in one shipment?" she proposed. "Easier if it's in bars. Once Morgan had the gold, it would be very tempting to help the other side win," said Masters. Jade's eye scanned his. "Why carry that much gold without an escort ship? Why call attention? Better to be discreet. No one expected there to be gold on her passenger ship." Masters poured a glass of wine. "Think about how good with words Morgan would have to be to get them to give him all that gold." "That's a hell of a lot of money," said Masters. "Why would they trust him?" Jade asked. Masters lit a cigarette. Jade's eyes were deep in thought. Why on Titanic, with all eyes on her for the maiden voyage? Why not on a less prominent ship that could sneak out unnoticed? "Hide it in plain sight," said Johns. "I like that," she said. "But why put it all on one ship? Maybe Morgan did it just to show he could do it right under everyone's nose, while everyone is focused on the fanfare." Jade looked out to sea as the ripples glistened under the night sky. Chapter 5. Titanic, Southampton Docks, 1912. Champagne was the order, as Titanic's maiden voyage extravaganza had promised. The oversized bottle was smashed. A bubbling flow across her bow. The ribbon cut. It was all too spectacular and the crowds gathered. Poof. The sound of the camera lights as still photos were taken of Captain Smith on the bridge. These would go to magazines and the newspapers, heralding the fantastic adventure of this giant's debut. Steam poured out the huge funnels. It was as if she was bigger than life. The greatest ship of the day was ready to make its mark. Captain Smith's uniform was white and pristine, like he had just stepped from the shop. It fit him well and made him a noticeable figure up atop this towering liner. His cheeks were seasoned from years at sea, his cap doing little if anything, against the force of wind and sun, but giving him the final touch of authority. He had a grandfatherly look that went well with his status. He petted his pearl-white beard as he stood on the bridge and then folded his hands behind his back. He checked the chronometer on the bulkhead and took note of the time. Glancing a moment or two, he looked at the passenger list, the provisions list, and passed them off to the officer in charge. All very good indeed. Thank you, Mr. Hume. Carry on. Smith had stepped out to watch the upper class arrive at the dock with all the hustle and bustle befitting this magnificent voyage. He liked the attention his standing commanded. His mind was going over all the details for the voyage. "Oh, look. It's the captain," said Mr. Washington Dodge as his luggage was brought up. The first-class passengers who had come aboard the luxuriously fitted ship were insistent on the class system. They liked the accoutrements that came with their status. They were in part, in and of the age of moguls, where the flaunting of one's wealth, and quite so, was noted in columns in the New York Times and well-known magazines, as high society glamour. "I had to bring my minx. It's so chilly on the Atlantic," announced Mrs. Fletcher. They reeked of wealth and stature in their silks, minks, and latest styles of fashion. They upstaged themselves the way they waited for their servants to open their doors. The white-gloved servants carried their luggage and followed up behind them. It was all too extravagant. These well-dressed tycoons and baronesses, businessmen and millionaires, came aboard on a separate plank marked First Class Passengers. The three-tier system on these liners provided privacy. Each class had its own decks. But the first class had a gymnasium, pool, and select dining on the above decks. And of course, the intriguing games of cards that allowed the exchange of wins and losses among gentlemen in black ties and tails, with after-dinner cigars. The high afternoon teas for the women were elegant and kept the ladies' minds from the troubling thought of anything other than gossip. "Meet for cards, shall we?" said Mr. Harris. "After we dine with the good captain." It was these privileged few that Smith mingled with. He stood proud on deck as a camera snapped his photograph for the press. And there was a man with one of the latest inventions from the turn of the century, a moving picture camera getting shots of the day. Smith stood at his best on the bridge. While the ship was at rest, he acted for the camera. He looked the part, posing toward the lens. Captain Smith greeted this class with all the necessary attention that he had been best known for. They felt safe in his hands. They adorned him with that special trust normally bestowed upon a dapper grandfather. The photos of Smith with the luxury liner and the well-to-do made the papers, which added to his legend. Below, in steerage, the clothes were plain, stitched and patched, and smoke filled the bar in third class. They were resigned to this main gathering place for meals and drink, in the hours when the moon took to play, as the sun slept on the other side. The wooden tables were waiting for the evening partying of the feisty Irish. And that was one thing the Irish could do was party, celebrate and toast to this venture and their expectations of the new land, so far across the sea. The ship had been designed to cash in on the steerage passage. Especially the bar. But with three squares, a bed and washstand, and accommodations down the hall, none complained. Here below, there were no fancy gaieties or frivolous expenditures. Their minds were preoccupied with the future. The land of opportunity? What jobs will there be? They had been lured by the stories. Their prime concerns were to find work and feed the mouths of their little ones, at their destination so far away, across the shiny sea, but that was another story. Chapter 6 North Atlantic Ocean, 1993. The following day had dawned crisp, clear and cold. The first light of the North Atlantic winter was now mingling with the cobalt sky. Soft shafts of streaky red painted the horizon with brush strokes only the sky could manage. Dudley was up bright and early, to order a thorough check of the sonar equipment. His hands were gloved to keep in the little heat afforded by his heavy overcoat. His chin was unshaven this early morn as he pushed the gears of the hoist. The wind flapped his neck scarf as he wrapped it tightly and tucked it in his collar. He checked the taut line of the anchor. 30 minutes to launch. Dudley's word disappeared quickly into the sea air. Day dive operations, pre-dive check, system warm-up. All complete, said Johns. Is the A-frame hydraulic powered up? Asked Masters. Powered up, answered Johns. Flynn tapped his fingers to his head as a yes. Suit up. Move to launch position, Masters said to Billy on Greg. Permission to move the vehicle out. The bridge answered yes. The wind swell and drift have been considered. With each order, Jade felt the tension building. They could afford no mistakes or last-minute hitches. Not on Dudley's dime. All stations manned and ready, he said. The ship and all its crew did not come cheaply, that much was certainly true. They had to make progress with his venture. He went around Nemo and gave her a look like a man does when he buys a car and kicks the tires, like that does any good. Dudley had to be on top of his game. It was his last go at a prospect like this. The smell of fresh brewed coffee caught the nose of Johns as he rubbed his gristle and entered. He knew better than to drink anything before a dive. He grabbed a couple of donuts. The sun was below the horizon with breathtaking soft dark tones of the early sky, as they made their way outside. Jade seemed outwardly calm, resigned to what lay ahead. She too held off the coffee. Pete, the operator pulled down his cap so that it covered the crevices in his forehead. Not that he cared, but he was used to wearing it that way not to lose it in an upswell of wind. He had lost a few that way. He moved over to the table now with his steamy coffee to attend the logbook. He reached in his baggy pants and found his pen as he grabbed a swig of his black brew, wiping his lips with the edge of his cuff. He flipped the pages then turned the book toward Jade. The sound of a click of his pen came as he released the ink tip. He held it out for Jade to give record of her presence on the dive. She took it and put the pen to the paper. There were the signatures of Danny, Masters, Flynn, and Johns, dried in ink on the page already. The pen froze in her hand, not from the brisk morning, but from stalling. If she wrote her name, that was it. The pen was on the line waiting for her mark. It seemed a common thing, but now it had so much more attached to its significance. Come on, give in. Sign it, Johns thought. Sign it, thought Flynn. She noticed how her signature looked as each letter appeared. Letter by letter, Titanic drew closer. As each letter left the pen, it dried so fast. She watched as if it was someone else's hand going through the motions. The unforgiving paper sealed her fate with the touch of the ink. She handed the pen to Mac, who scribbled like a doctor. Johns lead them to the mini-subs. Mac filmed as they headed toward the rigging for the subs, to venture below to Titanic. Master's crew was busy preparing the bots. Johns led Jade and Mac quickly down towards the stone-like face of Nemo. Jade got some shots of the ship. Damage from the rust had taken its toll on the Atlantic's iron. Years of salty air were tough on the metal. She could have used a coat of paint and a rest. Jade noticed it all. Her rubber-bottomed sneakers squeaked as they walked the wet deck. Each step drew Jade closer now to Nemo. Her thoughts were heavy. I've never done something like this before. Masters appeared and uncovered the cameras on Nemo and Nautilus. Both looked dark and ominous in the pale light of dawn. Yet Jade couldn't help but notice how new Nemo looked. The fresh new craft had been pampered and polished. No one spoke a word and the tension in the air was tangible. This was a momentous occasion for them all, and truth be told, they were all more than a little nervous at the prospect, but of course the men did not show it. Jade had her thoughts on the gold. It brought a new perspective to this venture and certainly had sparked the imaginations of the crew.